Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to the first non-Dan Dresner-centric, secretly educational episode of The Churn, Pandemic Edition. Today, we're going to talk about Chuck Wendig's The Wanderers, a true doorstop of a book that is about a global pandemic of a novel respiratory disease that appears to have jumped from bats to humans.
Hi, and I'm Dan Dresner, co-host of The Churn. So there is a lot going on in this book. Partisan domestic politics, social media freakouts, bureaucratic politics within the Centers for Disease Control, right-wing militias, societies breaking down, and, oh, that's right, an artificial intelligence that might be responsible for the end of the world. And we are going to talk about it all, first between Anna and myself, and then between us and with the author.
Dan, you have read the book more recently, I will confess, and I know the plot is fresh in your mind. Do you want to do... Okay, this is like a 700-page book.
Yes.
So, I know you've thought about this. Can you do a concise summary for our listeners?
I think I can. This is an interesting challenge. If I do not manage to do this in under 4 minutes or 5 minutes, let's say 5 minutes, I want you to call me out on it. So I've worked hard on this. All right. The Wanderers starts in Makers Bell, Pennsylvania, in which a girl named Nessie starts leaving her house and walking along the road completely unawares, walking as if she is in a trance, skin impervious to penetration, and she starts superheating if her bigger sister Shauna tries to stop her from walking westward. Soon, it is clear that she is not the only one doing this, that more and more people, as she continues to walk, join her in this sort of, you know, mindless kind of zombie walk westward. Eventually, soon, the CDC is called in to investigate. This includes a CDC subcontractor relying on an artificial intelligence called Black Swan. The subcontractor brings in a controversial former CDC investigator named Benji Ray to consult on what is potentially going on in Makers Bell, Pennsylvania. This is also happening in the middle of a heated presidential election, see if this sounds familiar, between a milquetoast liberal named Nora Hunt and a Trump-like GOP buffoon named Ed Creel. Over time, the walkers begin to grow in number to the hundreds. And along with the walkers and the CDC and the cops that monitor them, you also see family members who start tending to these people, these walkers, insisting that they are alive and should not be treated as a threat. They are called the shepherds. This generates a lot of political controversy in the middle of a heated presidential race. There are fears of contagion going on. There are fears that this is what we would call millenarianism, or a signal of end times. And indeed, one pastor in Indiana named Matthew, who we'll talk about, skyrockets to fame by calling them the devil's pilgrims. So as things develop, we learn a massive, and here's a massive spoiler alert for the book. It turns out the walkers are not the promised pandemic. The promised pandemic is something called white mask, which is a fungal pathogen that transmitted, as Anna indicated, from bats to humans, that is both more patient and more resilient, unfortunately, than human beings. It turns out that the walkers are indeed linked to this infection, but not for the reasons that you think. It turns out that Black Swan had actually released a series of nanites or nanotechnology that gets infected into people chosen by Black Swan. The reason their skin is impervious to touch is to render them essentially immune to this white mask fungus. Because of the nature of white mask, which is it takes months to infect people and you can be asymptomatic and nonetheless contagious, and it has a projected 100% fatality rate, it turns out that everything falls apart. There are coups. There are natural disasters. Society breaks down. Militias blame, of course, the walkers for all of this. And the question is essentially, will humanity as a species survive this incredibly virulent pathogen? And will the sort of walkers and shepherds and so forth manage to get to their final destination, which is Ouray, Colorado, and manage to establish an outpost for the future of humanity?
And the biggest spoiler alert is they seem to succeed. That mm-hmm. the ark created by Black Swan finds land, if we want to continue to use the ark metaphor. We have a something of a tradition from our, you know, Expanse podcast of sharing what we think of as a quote that sort of encompasses the entire, you know, idea of what we're talking about, sort of a representative thought. And, you know, this is a political book.
Oh, yeah.
it is not ashamed of that. Mm-hmm. There's this book is a lot of things. It is not subtle. and so I have a very unsubtle quote. Here is how we do things in America. We identify a problem, then we promptly ignore it until it's not just biting our ass, but it's already eaten the right cheek and has started on the left.
It just occurred to me, it's interesting. So you're the one who chose, the quote you chose is obviously very political in some ways, or, you know, defining the national character of the United States. The quote I picked out is in some ways more about human beings in general, not just Americans. The quote that stood out to me was, humanity, whether you were optimistic or pessimistic, was either a hardy breed of survivors or a swarm of cockroaches on the wall. And indeed, you know, one of the things that comes out in this book is that it turns out that humanity might be a wee bit more resilient, but barely more resilient than the artificial intelligence had originally estimated.
I think we should sort of get our general kind of thought about the book out of the way so people know if they want to continue. Maybe, I don't know. I liked it. I liked it very much. I read it really fast. It gave me all kinds of like waking nightmares because I was reading it just as the coronavirus was starting appear. I downloaded the book in January, early January.
Mm. So, oh, wow.
Yeah. Like I said before, it is not subtle. If anyone knows Chuck Wendig from his Twitter personality, that won't be a surprise. He is kind of a, you know, upfront dude. But I found its message somewhat subtle. I mean, it's not message. That's not what I want to say. It is equivocal about the nature of humanity in a mm-hmm. way that I found interesting.
I'm going to push a little bit. How do you think it was equivocal?
Sort of, it goes back to your quote. Yeah. Whether you're optimistic or pessimistic, they're a swarm of cockroaches, which is kind of a funny thing to say. But I don't feel like he comes down firmly on whether or not, A, humans are controlling their own fates, or B, whether humans have some kind of innate goodness. And also, the book doesn't end in a way that you can say is optimistic or pessimistic.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
I think those are the things that he manages to balance, whereas like a lot of stuff in there is like, you know where he stands. These huge questions, I don't think he quite telegraphs. Or he maybe doesn't know himself. We will ask.
For me, so I read this in March on your recommendation, and I'm not going to lie. It took me a little bit to get into it. I like the second half of the book much more than I like the first half of the book. Although now that I've finished it, I think I do appreciate the first part of the book more. And there's a chapter title, which I actually, the reason I liked it, called Apophenia. And the chapter title refers to the human tendency of seeing patterns that don't exist. And in some ways, the first half of the book is, in retrospect, very clever because Wendig sets up a number of different possibilities about what's going on. And, you know, as you're reading it, at least as I was reading, I was like, oh, okay, it must be this. Oh, it must be this. It must be this. And then, you know, about halfway through, you get what I can only describe, at least for me, was a gut punch of the recognition of what the actual pandemic is going to be about, which is white mask. And in that description, you know, Wendig makes it very clear that we are about to see humanity, you know, dealing with an extinction level event. And that leads to the second half of the book, which I simultaneously liked a great deal. And also, I'm not going to lie, I'm going to caution listeners about whether or not they should read it, depending upon their mental state. Because if they are freaked out by the pandemic that we are currently undergoing, I'm not sure I would recommend reading this part of the book. Because one of the more disturbing aspects, the parts of the book that stood out to me by far were the sort of tail end of societies breaking down. There is a chapter in there that is utterly, it's only like three or four pages, it's utterly chilling of once the federal government has essentially ceased to exist, of like whole cities and how they are wiped out. Because among other things, like I think in one of the examples, there's like a hurricane that hits Miami that in an ordinary society would be like a category one or like nothing too large. But because society is already dealing with the other crisis, is utterly devastating. And I have to admit, this morning, I believe Axios actually put out a news story about, in fact, the notion that FEMA is preparing for the fact that it could be a serious hurricane season this summer, which will be problematic. And there's also the other scene that just was haunting was a description very briefly of the Las Vegas Strip in sort of the middle of this pandemic, where people who by this point, you know that you've got it if you have a, you know, if you've got what seems like a head cold and there's description of like fungus that is coming out, tendrils coming out of your face. And it's just this awful, horrific description that I nonetheless could not stop reading about what, you know, essentially Vegas looks like in end times, which is kind of like Vegas now, just, you know, just with much more psychotropic drugs, and nudity and so forth.
So I agree with you that people who are in a delicate mental state, by the way, if you aren't, wow, like more power to you. I mean, I believe that describes all of us. But in a particular sense, if you are very freaked out about the virus in particular, I agree with Dan, don't go there. And then there is a fairly graphic description of sexual violence is intense. It has to do with the plot. It is important to the plot. But some people will find it very difficult. Well, actually, hopefully everyone finds it difficult to read.
If you read the scene and did not find it disturbing, please consult your local psychiatrist.
Yes, exactly. So that's just a content warning for that. And the other thing that was really disturbing about sort of the level of detail and realism in the book is he clearly has done a lot of research on the CDC.
Yes.
And how one discovers and follows pandemics. And I feel this way about a lot of genre writing, which is that it kind of hangs on the level of verisimilitude that can be achieved within the universe that is fictional, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Everything that exists in these fictional universes has to be as real as possible in order to make the fiction more believable. And he's clearly really just gotten into how this all works. And I actually want to read something about what he says about the CDC that might remind you of where we are today.
Oh, dear.
They had no idea what this was, where it began, or what it could do. And thus the true danger of a brand new pandemic became overwhelmingly clear. Act too slow, it could take over. By the time they figured out what it was, it could have raced through the population. Alternatively, act too fast, too harshly, and there were legal consequences. They did not have broad, sweeping powers, and for good reason. There had to be a balance between measured investigation and swift action, or else they'd either be in a full-blown pandemic or locking people up in camps.
Yeah. So I agree with you on this. I mean, in some way, there's a large part of this novel that is what I would describe as a procedural, in the sense of part of what draws you in is the description of procedures about an aspect of life that otherwise you wouldn't necessarily pay attention to. This novel is facing a tough test because suddenly it was striking to read it now in a world in which terms like zoonotic or PPE or, different divisions of the CDC are now common knowledge if you are reading the newspaper. And he does nail all of that. And the degree to which, he does mention, you know, SARS, COV and the MERS virus and coronavirus, I think it's a brief cameo appearance there. There was all sorts of disease trivia as well, discussing the 1918 pandemic and a variety of other sort of smaller, more bizarre pandemics that that I thought were interesting. The other aspect for me that stood out was the description of the CDC itself and sort of the bureaucratic politics of the whole thing. There is a moment at the that stood out for me, which was the degree to which the CDC folks are obsessed with data, and they are obsessed with data as a way, frankly, to process or to not process the fact that they are in the middle of a catastrophe. So the two quotes that stood out to me was one that I think Benji said or thought to himself, which was, "Death was a tragedy, but death was also a data point," meaning that the only, you know, particularly in dealing with the Wanderers, they had a difficult issue of they couldn't gather any samples from these people precisely because, or very minimal because they were impervious to needles. But nonetheless, they could, in theory, grab something if someone died and therefore actually get information. And then once White Mask becomes clear to the CDC, there is this scene where Benji Ray, who is in some ways the protagonist, who had been disgraced from the CDC because he had falsified data about a manufacturing plant that was clearly going to generate something problematic, but nonetheless had not done so anyway, trying to say, we need to tell everyone. And the head of the CDC says, we don't leak, we follow protocol. And of course, this is the problem with bureaucracies in dealing with a novel situation, which is almost always when that happens, their instinct is to, in fact, follow protocol because that's the one thing they can be sure about, even if these standard operating procedures don't apply in a non-standard situation.
Dan, you know what? That reminds me of something we've talked about before.
Yes.
There's some political science like paradigm that you're talking about and not actually naming the paradigm, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's called bureaucratic politics. Yes.
It's not a very fancy name.
It's the bureaucratic politics model, basically, that says that organizations, in order to be able to function, need to develop singular cultures and routines and standard operating procedures in order to be able to process reality. And the very things that make them generally able to do that during normal times sometimes incapacitates them in terms of coping with unusual situations, which certainly, you know, either White Mask or the actual coronavirus qualifies as.
So people might be wondering, like, why we're really talking about the CDC and the procedural part and the disease and the breakdown of cities. And I think that's because to the extent, you know, there's sort of a weakness in the structure of the novel. I would say that some of the relationships that are portrayed are not as richly sort of involving, immersing, as you might find in more, you know, I don't know, fancy fiction or something. I mean,
I'm laughing at the idea of fancy fiction. There needs to be a podcast entitled Fancy Fiction.
Yes. One doesn't read genre necessarily for, like, this part, right?
No,
I'm not saying he does a bad job, but we should talk about the relationships, even though.
Right. Well,
that's not the part that fascinates.
Right. I guess the way to put it is without casting aspersions, there is no Clarice Starling in this novel. You know,
right.
that in that sense, there's no, I mean, there are characters that are interesting, I think. And I think we actually both wound up agreeing that the character that was most interesting was Matthew, the pastor. Would that be correct?
Matthew Bird.
Yeah, Matthew Bird. So I mean, the principal characters, you know, are Benji Ray, who is the CDC person, Shauna, who is the sister of Nessie, who is the very first walker. And I did like the relationship that Shauna winds up developing with Arav, I think, who's a young CDC investigator. The character that stood out for me also was Matthew Bird, who is this pastor in a sort of small Indiana town who, as the flock comes through, winds up temporarily selling his soul, basically, that he rather than calling the, you know, that as these sort of right wing movements start, you know, interpreting the flock as a threat, he gives this sort of hellfire and brimstone sermon, calling them the devil's pilgrims and, you know, vaults to notoriety, under the patronage of this sort of local heavy, I guess. I don't know how.
And then have anyone seen Ozark? it would be the Snell family.
Yes.
Right? Yes. It would be that family sort of. Yes.
That's a good parallel. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll jump in because I think, sort of as far as realism and detail goes, what that whole subplot represents is something that maybe would have seemed unrealistic 6 months ago, which is the politicization of a disease. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean politicization just in terms of like who comes down with it and having judgment on them. Although maybe I do. Maybe all diseases are politicized. What I mean, though, specifically is the belief in the disease, whether it exists or not.
Yes. And this is where things get, you know, because it's in some ways, to be fair, so the one thing that struck me as a little odd, at least in the first half of the book, is I was surprised there wasn't more, not even necessarily panic, but prudence in terms of the pathway of the walkers. Because if it turns out that people keep joining this flock, wouldn't your natural instinct be, if you were living somewhere there, to get the hell out? Because it does suggest a kind of infectious pattern, which, as it turns out, we do realize it is. I mean, it's actually, you know, it's admittedly biomechanical rather than biological. But nonetheless, I was surprised more people didn't flee the trajectory of the walkers.
Yes, right. There are some halts.
Yeah.
and some detours. But I want to go back to a strength. Mm-hmm. Which is some of the background noise, including the election, really adds to the sense of this is really happening. This could really happen. This is how people would react if this really happened. Twitter goes on for longer than you'd think. That is actually, you know, Twitter is apparently impervious to viruses to a certain extent.
One of the more effective devices in the book, it's divided into, even though it's a long book, I would say very few of the chapters are longer than 10 pages. It's a series of very short chapters. And each of the chapters usually opens with an epigram of something of some kind, either like a fake tweet or, you know, a quote from Reddit or what have you. And Wendy does an excellent job there, I think, I agree, of sort of weaving in real life characters with fictionalized characters, you know, like, I mean, he has like a Fox News person that doesn't exist. But then actually the one that freaked me out was there was an opening in one of the chapters of Jake Tapper interviewing Ed Creel, who is the Trump stand-in, essentially. And it wasn't that far off from reality, I would say, you know, in which Creel winds up like stomping off the set because Jake Tapper is Jake Tapper.
Yes. Another thing in this book that will stand out to those of us who sort of pay attention to the let's say, conversation in genre and YA circles about representation is that he is very attentive to representation of gender identity, race, politics, religion. Like, you will find yourself, you will find someone in this book, no matter who you are. That speaks to you, which is something that has been missing from a lot of fiction, period, you know, and it can feel a little like, oh, I see what he's doing here. But I think that's how things might feel for a while in our world as people start to, especially for us white people, we're going to notice the integration, us white, straight, you know, able-bodied people. We're going to notice the integration of more marginalized communities more than others might.
Yes,
I think
that's a safe statement. And I want to push you to ask, you know, in terms of, so I think the book covers a lot. And I think the other way in which, the other big takeaway I have from reading it was there's a reason why I think I actually enjoyed this more in some ways than reading a sort of even a good zombie novel like World War Z or Zone One or so on and so forth, because as someone who's written a lot about the zombie genre, the thing about the zombie genre is that if you read a zombie novel, you already know the basic rules about zombies, right? I mean, you know, you know, and almost anyone who's going to read these books already has at least some basic, you know, grounding of how this works. In some ways, reading Wendig's book was interesting because it's much more of a puzzle. You don't know what's going on. And so in that sense, it does evoke, I think, the current moment, because even, you know, we're now in, what, month 3, I think, of dealing with COVID-19. And yet, I don't know about you, but the more I read about this disease, the less I'm entirely sure about anything. And it's true, the more data we even have, you know, the degree to which we know, you know, what is, I think, CFR is the acronym for fatality rates and the ways in which it can get spread. We know a little bit more than we used to, but there's also just still massive amounts of uncertainty. So I feel like we're in the beginning stages of our current novel in that sense.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, having, you know, been through a month and a half of quarantine time, the current unpleasantness, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are feeling like we're at some transition point. You know, we had a beginning of a new month, and both where you and I live, both places, all of a sudden spring has sprung.
Yes.
It feels like there's a new kind of chapter, at least. And I was listening to the news this morning, and they said, like, even in states where there hasn't been an official opening up, the cell phone data and travel data is saying that people are going out more.
Right.
And that there is probably the sense that we've gotten through something. We have not.
Well, it's a weird, this is where we don't know. And I mean, this is the sort of the giant uncertainty about this, because on the one hand, yes, I think people are being out and about more. I think you and I were both out and about yesterday. It was a gorgeous day yesterday mm-hmm. here. It was the first really...
Although I was social distancing, I'm sure you were too.
Right. Well, that's the question. The question is, you know, are people out and about and behaving responsibly, or are people out and about and not quite behaving responsibly? And so one of the interesting things going forward, and this doesn't quite... This part isn't in the book, and it'll be interesting to consider, is whether even if you get clear guidelines for how to behave in order to avoid being infected, can human beings in the 21st century in the United States actually do that?
You know, I think that sort of bringing it back to the book in this regard, we in particular, and I think a lot of people in general, have been looking at these past 6 weeks and thinking, you know what, this restores my faith in humanity. Look at everyone right. wearing masks. Like, look at everyone, you know, thanking the frontline workers. Mm-hmm. Look at how we expanded our definition of frontline workers. And I felt pretty good about yeah. humanity. What thinking about this book does for me is remind me sort of what you're saying, which is that we are in early chapters.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to humanity, good, bad, behave, not behave, follow guidelines, not follow guidelines. I don't know what the end will look like, but I do suddenly realize I can only say, look at what a good job we've done for the past 6 weeks.
Right.
I don't feel like this book has reminded me I cannot project forward.
True. Although, so this is where
from the past 6 weeks.
The other takeaway I have from this, and this is, honestly, I think this depends on your personal preferences, which is, I read this, and I just binge watched a show on Netflix called Into the Night, which is a Belgian show of all things, about a plane that is flying westward to stay in the dark, because as it turns out, the sun has done something. So if you are, you know, in daylight, you will just die. And so almost all of humanity is wiped out. And this plane is trying to figure out how can they find a safe haven. It's a very short show, international, you know, actually kind of a good gripping thriller. But like, I've had people ask me, why in the hell would you watch that right now? And the reason I watch that right now is in the same reason I think I enjoyed the second half of the book, is that as bad as things are right now, they could be so much worse. They really could be. Like, you know, White Mask has a 100% or 99%, you know, fatality rate. The show that I just watched, you know, almost all of humanity is wiped out. And the weird thing is that watching those things makes me feel slightly better about the current situation, because whatever we know about the novel coronavirus, we know that it does not nearly have that kind of effect. We are having severe social dislocations. I don't mean to minimize the economic pain or the psychological pain that people are feeling. And yet, weirdly for me, seeing these other things, you know, it's same with Contagion or Outbreak or what have you, you know, watching these narratives for me makes me feel weirdly better, because it's not the worst case scenario just yet. There are ways in which it can get worse.
I guess I'll just circle back to what I said before, which is I found the lack of resolution to be somehow edifying, that we are neither good nor bad, mm-hmm. you know, but that we are survivors, and that is actually in and of itself, perhaps, maybe a good thing. Like, the AI in the book is not so sure.
Right. Well, the other thing I liked about the end of the book, without giving anything away, was also that it does touch on religion a little bit.
Yeah. Dan, I was actually going to say, that's a big blank spot we're going to have to bring up with Chuck.
Yeah.
Which is the central metaphor of this book. Mm-hmm. Is shepherds and flock. And
right.
I'm not sure if you're aware of the major religious text in our country.
Yes, I have some vague knowledge of that. Although I've only read I haven't read the New Testament, but yes, I'm vaguely aware that there might be some Christian tropes going on there. But yes, I like that. And I think I said this in one of our previous episodes. When I wrote the zombie textbook, the one thing in terms of domestic politics that I kicked myself that I didn't include, which I should have, was in fact the idea of sort of the rise of new religious movements in response to any kind of apocalypse. And so I did like the way that this book ended in that sense, because that was totally believable.
Yeah. And I think that's a good place for us to use the advantage we're going to have by talking to the,
I agree.
Actual author. We won't just have to wonder. As it were, different, that's a pun, I guess, about what it all means. We're going to be able to ask him, and we're going to be able to ask him after we take a short break. So we'll be right back.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to the show, Chuck. We're so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, Chuck.
This is awesome.
So I want to dive in with a question that almost seems irrelevant in the current context, but I'm still curious, which is, where did you get the idea? So we now know, because of all the coverage of coronavirus, that people have been predicting pandemics for decades.
Yeah.
But for you... why pandemics for this particular story that you wanted to tell?
Well, what's interesting is I had the kind of core mechanic of the story for years. That whole thing where people start sleepwalking one after the next to an unknown place for unknown reason was kind of with me for a long time. It was one of those ideas that just hits you in the shower when you're mowing the lawn or whatever. And I'm often fond of saying that authors are asked the question, where do you get your ideas? But the better question is always, how do you make the ideas stop? Because they're just a constant meteoric barrage against the moon that is our brain. So I no longer write down any of my ideas. I treat them kind of like they're costume jewelry rather than precious gems. Like, it's kind of all what you do with them. And I want the ideas to survive kind of like idea Thunderdome inside my brain. So
survival of the fittest.
Yeah, survival
ideas.
Of the fittest. Yeah. Darwinian memetics kind of going on. Like, I wanted, if that idea won't let me go, then that's maybe an idea I need to pay attention to. So
as an academic, I appreciate the notion of idea Thunderdome. That's awesome. Keep
thank
going.
You, thank you. who rule idea town? So that one just kind of pestered me for, I guess, about 4 years. And I had nothing to do with it. I mean, it had no narrative, had no characters, had no nothing, just that idea. So, and then about 10 years ago was the year 2016. And in that far away time,
the before time.
All of my anxieties about everything, politics and white supremacy and global warming and antibiotic resistance and climate change, kind of all formed a big old anxiety Voltron for me. And in doing that, it gave context to this story. And so out arose Wanderers, this sort of pandemic story that isn't just about virality of, in this case, multiple kind of pandemics actual in the book, but also with ideas and the pandemics of ideas and the pandemics of community and the how things spread and connect people in different, strange, unexpected ways.
I actually just sort of got another layer of that with the fungus being a kind of thing that connects.
Yeah, it's like mycelial connections.
Ooh. Huh. Yeah. Chuck, I'm curious. You captured an awful lot of the sort of CDC argot and procedures in your book, particularly in the first half. The one thing that I was wondering, and in some ways this is unfair because it's sort of reading during this pandemic, but the one thing you didn't mention even to dismiss it was the idea of social distancing in response to white masks. So I'm kind of curious, like, is that one of those things you wish you could go back and change, or you just, I mean, how would you treat that now?
The trick, well, first of all, obviously you learn so much about the world when you're going through a pandemic.
it's an unfair question. I just want to put that out there at the beginning. Yeah.
If I would have known toilet paper was a thing, I would have put that in the book. I feel like that would have been currency in the New World Order. So the other thing was, because I wanted the danger of the white mask pandemic to be something that was basically like we're probably already infected. Right. At that point, social distancing felt like one of those too late measures. And then it's also on the wind because they're learning that these things are erupting out of people. And so at that point, social distancing felt like a thing that was not a focus of the book. And we kind of actually in that point in time, there's a little bit of a fast forward, a little bit of a jump as stuff is kind of. I just skipped some of that stuff. Let's just go with that.
Totally fair.
And this kind of build on that. And again, it's sort of unfair because you were talking about a possible imaginary world and we're here. Is there anything that's happening now that you wish you had put in? You said toilet paper, but anything else?
Yeah, the toilet paper is just because it's such a peculiar detail that they don't know to include those kinds of supply chain breakdowns. I mean, meat is sort of an obvious one, but you know, paper products is an odd one, or flour, everyone's baking bread. At the same time, as much as I wish I had included those things, the book also tries not to get, it's already a really big book, and I didn't want it to get too into the weeds of like daily pandemic life, which is obviously the kind of thing we're talking about here. I wanted it to still have, despite it being a big 800-page book, I wanted it to occasionally have that thriller sense of urgency, at least the sense of like at the end of every chapter, you want to get to the next one. And at the end of the day, like bread baking and toilet paper is not always the best hook to kind of reel them in. Otherwise, yeah, that's... That was definitely one of those things where, you know, you just didn't know.
Was it Moby Dick that had all the chapters on knots?
Yes.
You know, like you could have had your own chapter on sourdough starters. I know. You missed your chapter.
And it's a fungus. So, I mean, like, or, you know, like I could have done something there. Yeah. Everyone's like suddenly afraid of their sourdough starters.
I get the resistance, the idea of just like stuffing more, you know, individual things into the loaf, I guess. But I wonder about the larger social currents that we're seeing now. Like something that Dan and I have been talking about as we try to recover some optimism from zombie narratives and pandemic narratives is the fact that at least in these past 6 or 7 weeks, I, as a cynic, have been so pleasantly surprised by people's willingness to sacrifice for each other.
Well, and that's one of the things that Wanderers does. See, the thing about Wanderers is it doesn't focus over much on every American and everybody in society, but it does obviously put a lens on the flock.
This isn't a novel where where you're focusing on leaders or anything like that. It's much more small bore.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like it covers that peripherally, but it mostly tried to really lens these characters who are all together in this flock. And that is one of those places where I did try to invoke a sense of community that these people are walking with loved ones and friends and sometimes total strangers to the shepherds who go with the flock to protect People, they don't even know what their purpose is or if they're harmful or if there's a disease that they're carrying or what it may be. And so I really did want to have a sense of community amongst both the shepherds and then, you know, later with what evolves out of that group as they move across the country.
That brings up something I want to get to later, but I also want to bookmark because you made me think of it, which is what the shepherds are doing that's a little different from what we're seeing right now, and it's partially because, again, we have an imaginary world, is taking a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And that is something we're not having to sort of, I mean, that's not really a part of our national conversation right now. Maybe it should be.
No, and maybe it is abstractly because we're getting such poor communication from our leaders that so much of it is we're taking faithful leaps based on the kinds of things we're learning from doctors around the world or from people who are saying things who are maybe not connected to the informational supply chain. And that can also go to kind of tap into the virality of information a little bit. That can also go the other way, that some people are taking on faith a lot of bad information about numbers. And yeah,
there have been faithful leaps. It's just that there have been faithful leaps, not in the direction you would have wanted, along the lines of this will go away as the weather gets warmer, it'll go, or
right,
hydroxychloroquine or what, you know, things like that. So yeah, there have been some faithful leaps.
Yeah.
Chuck, this is primarily a novel that takes place in the United States, or it almost exclusively takes place in the United States. And there are a few references to how the rest of the world responds to White Mask, you know, Russia or China, and none of it is terribly good.
Yes.
I'm curious, based on the sort of the responses to COVID-19, do you think in your fictional universe, any of the smaller countries like Iceland or New Zealand or Singapore could have survived the apocalypse with actually something like an intact state?
Yeah, probably. You know, and it was originally there were multiple flocks around the world. And so they were rising in parallel to the to White Mask. And so I actually did start to cover things that were happening in China and things that were happening in Africa. But it felt, again, like a much bigger chunk of information to add to an already somewhat ponderously large book. And I didn't want it to become a 1,000-page or 1,200-page book or have to split it into two tomes. And so because the book started to feel so keenly American in what I was trying to talk about and the kind of people I was trying to deal with, and the American exceptionalism then becomes sort of folded into the kind of overall thing of it, the flock themselves, that it felt like a sharper tack to not worry too much about what was going on in the other countries and sort of just give peripheral glances and not get bogged down by that. But yeah, absolutely. I do feel that that's probably the case.
Yeah, this is a American book, like just very firmly, squarely American. And I know you as a Twitter presence, you know.
I'm so sorry for that.
You know, you are not afraid to comment on current events, let's say.
Yeah.
How much of this was being able to like say something about America right now?
It's interesting because on the one hand, it's exactly that. But on the other hand, it wasn't 100% intentional. I wasn't like, I didn't step into the page with a message mm-hmm. or a thing to preach or a viewpoint that I really wanted to hit home. It was just, I had all of these feelings and thoughts and just like stuff you've been sort of brining in America for so long and all of the good and the bad that comes with that. And mostly, you know, with the book, it's like trying to wring a sponge and get a lot of that out and see where it goes in whatever complicated, messy splash that it makes.
One of the things I really appreciate about the book is, I'm not going to use the right word, but ambivalence is almost it. Your refusal to kind of come down on a specific side on some things.
Yeah, and some people don't feel that way at all. I've gotten some reviews that are
say,
very...
I will say, there are some places where you are not subtle and
no.
you are very clear.
Yeah.
About how you feel. But I will pick out a couple of the places that I feel like it's a very interesting equivocation, let's say.
Sure, okay.
Or or provocation, perhaps, is an even better word, which is America is one of them.
Yeah.
Like, how you feel about America is not entirely clear. But maybe that's true for all of us. I don't know.
I hope it is, in a way, because if you live here and... you know, you obviously, if you have neighbors and community, obviously there's a level of, and you can see it now, like you're talking about that level of community that you're seeing that's in a positive way. that leap of faith that, you know, we're not having to take because you can see it outside our door that everyone's kind of, not everyone, obviously, but a lot of people are doing better and doing more for themselves and their communities than we thought. To me, that's, you know, where you get a little bit of that faith in America and that comfort level of where you live and in what we are. It's just, obviously, then you look beyond that to the administration and to everything that's being done, and that's where you start to lose faith again. So I think there's a constant push and pull, and I feel like that's the best way to be about where we live, is a sense of not blind patriotism, but a sense of hopefulness for what we can become, even though we were built on some pretty nasty business, and obviously continue to be built on that nasty business.
But this does give rise to my question, which is, in some ways, given the book you were writing, some of the characters are, you know, it's not surprising you have a protagonist who's at the CDC or a protagonist who's one of the first shepherds and so on and so forth. The two characters in the book that I wasn't expecting in some ways, or that are more wild cards, are, I think, Pete Corley, the rock musician, and then Matthew Bird, who is the reverend. I'm just sort of curious, what were your thought processes in terms of divining those? And in some ways, those are the most ambivalent, or I guess, it's easy in the book to sort of think, oh, Benji's a good guy, even if he's flawed, or Shauna's a heroine. With Matthew in particular, he goes on quite the journey, would be the way to put it.
Yeah. Matthew does go on a journey. And so does Pete to a different degree. I wanted to have someone who was tangling with that complexity of faith, who maybe was willing to question things, but also as you sort of get swept up by the movement of it, or the adoration of people as, because I mean, you know, a preacher suddenly has a real audience for the first time and is on the radio, and obviously Christianity, as it gets tangled up with white supremacy and what that can do to, you know, your brain if you don't realize that you're getting caught up in it. And I wanted to, as, which is really a tricky line to walk, have Matthew have that as gentle a descent as possible, so much so that when it's already happened, it's both not a surprise and also you didn't see it coming. When you look back, you can track it and say, I see the fall, but it's not just a one day he's like, oh, you know what, I'm a jerk now. Like, you know, I didn't want it to be that like polar, like we're flipping a switch and now Matthew is all in on this particular thing. He really needed to be a gradation, a gentle walk into hell kind of for him. And then Pete is just, first of all, that's sort of a Stephen King rock and roll protagonist is key. And I wanted to sort of upgrade that to and update it to where we are now and with, you know, sort of has been rockers. But also he's the most fun type of character to write, which is someone who even I don't know who they're going to do next, what they're going to do next. So you get this sense of chaos, like they're a Molotov cocktail thrown into a crowd, and you don't really know how the fire is going to go. And that's a lot of fun because it leaves you some room to just like there's an almost sense of inspiration and delight that comes from characters who go left when you expect them to go right.
I love the idea that novelists, you know, want to throw chaos Muppets into their books.
Absolutely. They're the best. Sometimes as like a key protagonist, a chaos Muppet is one of your most interesting tools.
Okay, since you brought up Stephen King, my father actually has been listening to Stephen King audiobooks. He just finished The Stand, and I just gifted him with The Wanderers, actually.
Oh, excellent.
And he's on chapter 5. Hi, Dad. You're probably further along now.
Hello.
And he loves The Wanderers. But so people must be asking you about comparisons to The Stand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's willful.
Okay.
Well, yeah, The Stand, I wanted to write a book where The Stand is a book that existed that people have read. And they reference, yeah. I mean, Stephen King is a reference throughout. Pete Corley has done, you know, albums based on King's work and, they, you know, reference The Stand.
Yes,
they also reference
that.
Zombie novels. Like, I'm always, the fact that, like, the Walking Dead is like, what are these strange, shambling undead? You're like, okay, all right, we all know by now. So I did want it to be, and it has some of those Kingian homages. You know, I didn't want to spend a lot of time in Vegas, but like I needed to just sort of have some Vegas in there just to sort of give us that, what would that be like now? And it's not supernatural in the way that The Stand is, but I still wanted to capture a little of that Kingian nostalgia of America, but also the poisoned nostalgia of America. But again, updated for, social media, the social media generation. The book obviously grapples with how things are happening on Tumblr just a little bit. Just like I wanted those little flavor points of, modernity to kind of come in.
All of the sort of Reddit and Twitter epigrams are very good at the beginning of the book, which, by the way, makes the moment when you get to there's nothing all that more disturbing as I was reading it. And actually, easily for me, the most disturbing passage in this book was that paragraph you had of Benji driving along the strip. That just freaked me out. I'm not going to lie. But I also love, by the way, that you mentioned one of my favorite B movies from the 80s, which is Night of the Comet.
Night of the Comet,
that's
right?
A great movie. Yeah. So yeah. I want to bring it back to King a little bit because one theme that The Stand and The Wanderers have in common that's something huge is religion, God. Yeah. We talked about you sort of specifically like grappling with it, but the book is, there's more than just the preacher. That's not your only character or your only way of grappling with God, obviously.
No, Benji and Black Swan, yeah.
Right. And the shepherds and the flock.
Yes.
All of this stuff. So I have one question that a little personal and deep, which is I don't know where you stand on God in general. Do you have a faith of any kind?
I am very firmly agnostic.
Okay.
I believe something must exist, but I am uncomfortable with being clear that it has a label or a origin point, just because, you know, as you study the world and you realize that there's so many people who believe so many different things, even though there's a lot of commonality or there's some shared space in all of those kind of circles. It feels egocentric to me to be like, well, it's clearly a God who emerged in this region with this name, and those people were totally right. And their holidays are the exact holidays, even though those holidays are stolen from the people whose, you know, temples and altars they kicked over. And so it feels like something's there, but I don't know what it is, and I'm not, I don't feel like I'm the expert to talk about it. So I'd rather put it in books instead.
Yeah. So you did put it in this book. There. That's the follow up question. Like, what were you trying to explore there?
I don't know. I just wanted it to be, you talked about that leap of faith earlier. And I do think there comes points, whether it's in how we build communities or what we're doing with the future or how we trust or don't trust our fellow Americans, as it were. There are leaps of faith in that regard. And just over time, emerging out of that grew this pattern of what you believe in and what is a God and can you make your own God? And what, as much as it's not a supernatural book or a book about magic or a literal power of faith, it's obviously in a science fiction context is kind of baked into the bread on that one.
I would actually say that to me, the most spiritual character, the most the character with the most faith is Shauna.
Interesting. Mm. Okay.
I mean, I think not faith in a higher power, but
sure.
Faith in community, faith in her sister, faith that there's something that's going to, there's a reason why she needs to be there. Like, because she starts with not knowing anything.
No, and just goes.
Yeah.
She just goes. Yeah.
That's a leap. That's the biggest leap to me.
It is. Yeah.
That's the biggest leap. But if you ask me who liked the most, the character for whom faith was the strongest, I'm blanking on her name. It was the former cop.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who literally hears...
Darcy?
Darcy,
oh, of course. Yeah, I'm sorry, yes.
Who hears the voices.
Yeah, the head injury, yes, of course.
Exactly. And you know, but in some ways that's because, the contrast is Sean is taking the leap without knowing what's going to happen, whereas the other character is literally getting information that suggests there's really something going on there, so...
Right, but then there's also explanations for that if you choose to accept them, so there's... Yeah. And Shayna does have
Sorry about the mispronunciation. I want to go back and correct all of those things.
Oh, that's all right.
Should she get mad? I think she would get mad.
She would get mad.
She gets mad, let's be honest. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
She's prickly way. Yeah.
she's a little prickly. Yeah. That's all right. Yeah. It's interesting because she does have so many instances of faith. And then still at the end, there is a turn away from a lot of that faith. Mm. So that's kind of an interesting perspective. Yeah. Mm.
So this book came out last year before any of the current unpleasantness, obviously. And I assume the bulk of the critical reaction, you got was when that book came out. I'm just sort of curious, how has the current unpleasantness affected the reaction to the book? Like, are you getting people who are like contacting you saying, you seer, you prophet, or what, you know? Yeah.
Yes, all the time, every day. I'm getting tweets and emails about like calling me Nostradamus and demanding I write a much nicer book next time. We all win the lottery and get unicorns and puppies and whatever else is golden and good.
Has it changed your relationship to the book?
No, not exactly. I mean, it's spooky in that just that some of the stuff that I was afraid of has either come to pass. Though also it's given a lot of nice perspective on the current moment that, well, it could be a lot worse.
That's Dan's philosophy.
That's my philosophy, yes.
It could be so much worse. You know, but everyone wants to know, like, how did you predict this? And it, like you said at the fore of this, this is not something I predicted. This is, first of all, pandemics, they happen nearly constantly. I mean, or potential pandemics are kind of always on the rise. Probably every 10 years we're in the crosshairs of something spooky and coming at us. So most of this stuff is just been there. I mean, you know, like, how did you know bats? Like, well, because it's always bats. It's been bats for a long time. Bats have long been a theorized, you know, vector for so many different things. So, and it's not to say bats are bad or we should all go out and kill bats. Bats are a wonderful part of our ecosystem. Just side note, let's put that out there because some people are like, why do you hate bats? I don't. I love bats. But the one that did get me was the article that was like, an algorithm predicted the coronavirus before it happened and it was called Blue Dot. And I was like, oh, it's a color and it's a BL color and it's two words. And I was like, oh, no. Maybe I did unleash something. I'm very sorry.
That actually, exact thing I was going to ask you about. Black Swan sort of starts out as a plot device and kind of becomes a character.
Yeah.
Is it a character?
Arguably starts out a character. You just don't know it.
But you know what? That is actually a good point. I mean, I'm wondering about Black Swan as a character.
Yeah. I do like Black Swan as a character. The question is what does it want and what does it think? And I certainly hope to get the chance to write more of that someday because that's, I think, a complicated question as to what Black Swan is.
Oh, that would be a sequel. I assumed that we were getting a sequel.
That would be a sequel, yeah. No, there's no guaranteed sequel. That's always been like one of those things where if the... If the sales in the story is there, then, you know, there's a sequel.
Well, what does Black Swan say about your own relationship to technology? Are you that ambivalent?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I am ambivalent. Like, on the one hand, it's very hard to deny... Okay, so I wrote a book called Invasive. And Invasive, the key character in that, the protagonist, is a futurist named Hannah Stander. And Hannah Stander's whole thing is about predicting those theoretically unpredictable threats that are to come. And the idea, of course, being that, you know, whether you're talking about splitting the atom or even a simple knife, most developments, extreme scientific developments, have the ability to feed the world or blow it up at some level. And so that's kind of where I am on technology. I mean, even now, it's so strange because, you know, like I have an 8-year-old and it was like, we need less screen time for our son. No, not screen time. And then this all happens. You're like, go talk to your screen, son. Like that's where all of the people live now. They live inside this box. Don't not talk to your screens. Like vitamins. So, even something like that can go literally both ways. And to me, that's sort of all of this, in some ways, all of this book. Like there's things that are, it's not that I'm trying to say that this is really good or really bad, because it's clearly both and neither in equal measure. It's just, it's a thing that exists and we have to grapple with the complexity of it and figure out what happens from there.
So it is a big book and I was legitimately impressed with how many of the loose ends you pretty much tied up. One question about a loose end that's not addressed in the book, which is, what happened to Autumn Bird?
Oh, Autumn Bird.
I wonder that as well.
No, there's definitely, I will say there's some loose ends that if there were ever a sequel, they will be addressed. Yeah, like where Pete goes, we don't know where Pete is.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Pete's just out there. Pete's just a wasteland warrior right now. I don't know where he is. I can promise he's not dead because he's Pete. He's that chaos Muppet. And he's not gonna die.
They're hard to kill.
Yeah, no, that's one of those. Yeah, they're very hard to kill. So this is definitely one of those things where were there a new book, it would be firmly tucked away in the hamster's cheek on that one.
All right. I feel like we can't let you go without asking an obvious question, which is, how are you?
Oh, boy. That is the hardest question. But here's, I mean, to be fair, all questions are really hard for me right now. like even basic, like simple questions. What do you want for dinner? I feel like I have a, I say like, it feels like I'm reaching in the cabinet, but instead of like, I know where the glass is, I have to reach through a wall of pudding first to get to the glass. Like, I'll get there. If I push through, I'll be like, how am I doing? Give me a minute. I mean, fine, quasi fine, fine adjacent. Like we're very privileged and we're very fortunate. You know, I am doing what I do is a, though the industry is going to certainly go through its, ups and downs on this one. So far, I seem to maybe still have a future doing it. And, so, you know, we have a house and our son is healthy and happy. So, good. I mean, as good as can be, but also at the same time, I try to recognize that while we have that privilege and fortune, it's sometimes it's okay to feel like, oh God, oh, what the hell is going on? It's okay to feel a little bit aimless and guideless in this peculiar moment.
So as someone who reads books like this, you know, because it could be so much worse and it's much worse in the book, I particularly appreciated, as I said, the second half of the book and as the sort of society starts to break down. And even this morning as we were having this conversation, other part of the book that really haunted me was there was a very short chapter on like how cities die out, you know, like Chicago having a freeze and like no one knowing what to do, and Miami having a hurricane that would ordinarily be fine, but because no one's processing. And literally, I read Axios this morning in which the FEMA director is saying, yeah, we're going to have a real problem because it's going to be one of the worst hurricane seasons potentially on record in Florida. So.
Yeah, so that complicates a pandemic. Exactly. It's like having a real heart attack in the middle of all this. You're like, well, do I go to the hospital? I mean, you have to go to the hospital, but then everything gets harder. Yeah.
But no, thank you. It was really well done.
Thank you.
And I will offer a thought on that, which is not my own, but I found helpful. It has to do both with the privilege and the fuzziness around how you feel, which is you can always add, I'm doing fine in coronavirus adjusted terms.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then also just on the mental health toll of all this, I have been reminded 1,000 times and I remind my friends 1,000 times, it's not a contest, you know, like bad feelings are bad feelings. And it doesn't matter like how much you have or don't have, you know?
Yeah.
It's just
when trying to force yourself out of them by thinking about how it shouldn't be there is not helpful either.
Yeah, but you've made me feel better by just having this wonderful conversation.
Well, yeah, thank you. This is great.
All right. I hope we can have an excuse to have you back sometime.
Yes, let's do that.
Well, that wraps up today's episode of The Churn. Please remember to subscribe to The Churn wherever you get your podcasts. Stay safe and wash your hands.